Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergriff.
It's Wednesday, May 15th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. From Beach to Breach, an ex-teacher graduates law school to change public policy.
Dance to This, Iona in the Tarot Patch.
An Emancipation Proclamation to take on 21st century slavery.
An object lesson on the life of objects.
Plus, the worldview from the BBC. It takes a village in the backyard. And who's going behind closed doors in today's reality check.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. What does it mean to be home? If you can answer in one word, Hawaii, then you already know. Zach Diono knew it when he moved here from New Jersey to teach special education, but he lost his job. He retooled his career. He went to law school. He got a Native Hawaiian law certificate. We talked to Zach early this year about changing education policy. He graduated law school last weekend. And is back for another slice of our conversation. What does it mean to be Haole and home in Hawaii to change it?
It's hard to talk about the education issues in the state of Hawaii without talking about the Native Hawaiian issues, because if you think about it, they're very similar and related. A lot of the education gap that exists in our state is with Native Hawaiian students and access to equal education opportunities. And then if you look back further, it's issues with poverty. It's issues with housing. And these all stem from larger issues as well, some that I've been able to explore in my studies while pursuing the Native Hawaiian Law Certificate. But when I think about working within education policy, I realize now that that has to entail several other components that affect the education policy issues. And yes, that will inevitably involve this exploration of Native Hawaiian issues and being able to address those first.
I mean, Zach, here you're a guy from New Jersey, and no disrespect, but for a lot of people who see you as, you know, the latest comer who's going to tell us all how it's going to get better or somehow be able to shine a light on the path, that may be tough for a lot of people who were born and raised here to handle. How do you walk that line when you're clearly, forgive me for using this word, a Haole?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And during the time that I've been in school, especially when pursuing this Native Hawaiian Law Certificate, I really had to check myself, and I've asked hard questions that I would never have thought of asking myself, even when I was teaching. You know, what is my role as a non-Hawaiian? What is my role as a white guy from the mainland? How do I broach these issues that I'm passionate about without coming in with that colonizer, conquistador mentality? And what I've learned, at least through my studies and through the wonderful professors that we have at the law school in the Native Hawaiian community, is that it's really important to sometimes just shut up and listen, listen to the issues. And for me, it's important to be able to do that, but at the same time, educate myself, learn about the history, learn about the legal history, and use my skills as a teacher and as a soon-to-be legal advocate to prepare for the opportunity that if someone says, Zach, what do you think? I'm prepared, I'm ready to provide help, research, whatever it takes. And it's an informed decision, but I'm only providing it because I've been asked. If I never get asked, maybe that's just the way it is. But I think it's important that people realize that you can't go into situations and just say, this is what we've been doing on the mainland. Sure, I can share those insights, but this place is different. And there needs to be a level of sensitivity that I don't always see in these conversations. And honestly, I didn't always have. But now I'm very fortunate to have taken on that new perspective.
Yeah, the listen more and say less thing isn't exactly something that would sync up with coming from Jersey, perhaps.
You know, in Jersey, we like to talk a lot. I mean, it's kind of tough to be able to convince people that yeah, you may have a fixated perception of what folks are from this part of the country, but here's why I'm different. And don't let me just tell you. Observe my actions and let me demonstrate to you that I'm someone that you can trust, that I'm willing to work hard for the issues. I'm willing to not lead, but I want to stand aside and if necessary, stand behind those who need to be leading the fight.
Isn't that really where it, in a way, has to start for you first? Because you've mentioned a couple of things. The idea about truly listening, saying less, being willing to shut up and just observe and see what happens, and to be able to fulfill yourself at the same time by doing that. Those last two seem to be a little bit out of sync with each other. How do you fulfill yourself in what you need to do with your life and what you've chosen to do? Or is learning how to do the other three all a part of that?
Well, if I want to continue doing what I'm doing in Hawaii, which is what I want to do, I want this place to be my home, I just need to work my butt off and make sure that I can accomplish the first three to get to the latter, because I don't see how someone can be successful in pursuing these kinds of goals without having the acceptance and even the permission to be a part of these conversations. So if that just means hanging out in the wings and preparing and learning all the different perspectives, because I think that's what's so important. You know, you think about, it's not just one Native Hawaiian perspective. There's a lot of different perspectives of what should happen, about how people feel about different issues. And so even aligning myself with one particular perspective could jeopardize me and alienate me from another group. So I think it's just so important for me to understand all perspectives, give everyone an opportunity to be heard and be a voice for those folks if needed. And then if my number is called, if someone decides to say, you know what, we think that you are prepared, you have a lot of experience in these particular areas, and we find that valuable for our cause, we'd like to have you sit at the table, then that's the opportunity that I'll have to be able to do what I want to do. I'm not going to be a type of person where if that doesn't happen, I'm just going to force a square peg through a round hole. I'm not going to just assert myself because, oh, well, no one's invited me to the table. And I think that's where the line gets drawn.
You can't possibly be involved unless you know those perspectives. But you know, even from the limited amount of time that you've spent learning now, that there are perspectives that are obviously at odds with each other. And by being with one perspective, that automatically says you are not with the other and puts you at odds with it. So, you know, there's going to come a point where you're going to have to make choices, and that will set you apart. So you can't be a friend to all and, you know, have the good intentions of being involved with everybody come to a point where you're able to not alienate people, as you said before.
No, yeah, and you're absolutely right. And I think that's where my role as a legal advocate, as a lawyer comes into play, is that I have to do my research. And I have to, at some point, even despite all these different conflicting perspectives, I have to be able to say, here's what my research has been, and here's what my informed judgment is.
How does all of this either shoot you down the path of education policy reform, or maybe show you that there is a different path for you? Because you mentioned that, obviously, education policy is part of everything that you've been studying with regard to being involved with Hawaiian causes and understanding the role of someone, you, in all of
right.
this. But your main driver when we first met was, we have to change education policy in Hawaii. Is that really where your heart still lies, and is that really where you're trying to still make a difference?
I think that's definitely where my passion, my heart lies, but I think the difference is I realize that you cannot change education policy in alone. There needs to be other factors that are changed. There needs to be other areas of legal recourse for disadvantaged members of our community. And if those things aren't addressed concurrently with the changes in education, then we're not going to see the level of education that the kids in Hawaii deserve.
For the moment, we're going to let you go, Zach. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, and happy graduation.
Thank you so much, Bethany. Appreciate it.
Zach Diono is a former special education teacher. He came to Hawaii through Teach for America and worked for 3 years at Ilima Middle School in Ewa Beach. When he lost his job, he went to law school to study, among other things, education policy. He graduated from the William S. Richardson School of Law last weekend and is quite happy to be Hawley in Hawaii. We reached him early this morning.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
The IRS and the Justice Department come under fire for harassment of the Tea Party and the press, respectively. Hillary Clinton takes more heat on Benghazi. And in Massachusetts, Republican Gabriel Gomez gains on Democrat Ed Markey. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin, plus former DNC chair Howard Dean on the future of the Democratic Party. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
It's The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HBR2. Later in the show, e-season is in the cards, but first, it takes a village in the backyard.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawai.
In 1960, Waikiki, there was a cultural village located at the Diamond Head end of Ala Moana Park, right across the current location of the Magic Island parking lot. It was started by Herman and Malia Solomon, who were inspired to create a living Hawaiian village. It would be a place where Kama'aina and visitors were treated to demonstrations of Hawaii arts and crafts, could experience life in pre-contact Hawaii. The couple hit on the idea after driving through the park and coming across a fenced enclosure of empty grass huts. They did some digging and discovered the area was used only during Aloha Week. Talked to the landlord, negotiated a lease, and the shacks became the backdrop for tapa-making, poi-pounding, kukui nut candle-making, and other activities that might otherwise have been forgotten. For today's quiz, can you name this Waikiki attraction? And for bonus points, can you tell us where it eventually relocated? We'll point you in the right direction in the next half hour.
Hi, good morning. I'm Brian Lee Sackett from Hawaii Repertory Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
You expect adventuresome work from Iona Contemporary Dance Theater, and with it, a new approach to presentation. We're now in the opening weeks of an innovative new approach to performance, an online e-season, in which a different card from the Living Tarot appears online each week. Cheryl Flaherty, Iona's artistic director, is on hand to explain. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. You're putting video online of past shows as an e-season.
Yes, it's just an effort to grow our online community and share some of our older works.
Makes
with the
good
public.
Sense. And this Living Tarot show would have been particularly difficult to mount again, wouldn't it?
I would love to, but it was created in a 100-year-old house on Pauli Highway. And we transformed the house and each of the 10 rooms in the house into 3D tarot cards with paint and jeweled walls and you name it. The house was going to be torn down, actually, so we were able to do whatever we wanted.
All the more reason to preserve the show, yeah?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of our other shows that will be coming up in future e-seasons mm-hmm. that the public would either like to see again or maybe they didn't see it, and they're sometimes challenging for us to recreate.
Well, it's a body of work that you wouldn't want to let just sit on a shelf, would you?
Yeah, it's been sitting on the shelf for a while,
really?
Actually, because The Living Tarot was presented in 2007.
Uh-huh.
And so we're editing it now, and it's exciting. It's a different format to see the show. You see a lot of things that you didn't see live, a lot of close-ups. Yeah, it's kind of fun.
With the idea of this particular show, the living embodiment of the tarot, which are used for divination, right? To
correct.
Assess the present, predict the future?
They are. They're also just to give an insight into your personal development. And so mm-hmm. the way we presented the show in 2007, I think, was very unique. We made our own tarot deck with our dancers featured mm-hmm. on the cards. Mm-hmm. And the audience came in, and we had docents that gave them each an individual tarot reading. And the order
oh, really?
Of their cards determined the order in which they saw the show.
Oh,
so
great.
Everyone saw each of the 5-minute tarot card pieces in a different order and therefore had a different experience.
So you didn't impose any order of presentation on it.
No, but what ended up happening is that the dancers, bless their hearts and souls, had to do each of their 5-minute pieces 10 times a night.
Oh, boy.
So they ended up doing their pieces 60 times over the run of the show. So they got very good at it, which was fortunate because now that we're editing that footage, they're extremely consistent. And so we're happy about that.
Because you have to edit different takes together, right?
We do. It's a little challenging.
Yeah, I would imagine. Especially with movement, yeah? Having movements kind of
sync
up.
Well, movement and speaking, there's about four or five of the cards that actually did theatrical work, too, and actually had live speaking with music going underneath of it. And then a lot of the cards had a lot of audience interaction as well. So there's that factor, too, of different audiences seeing the cards and, you know, getting footage without heads in the way and footage with heads in the way when
mm-hmm.
it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Well, that also gets to the whole, your identity as, you describe yourself as a contemporary dance theater, which definitely says that you're going beyond movement, right?
Absolutely, and very philosophical our work is, and we try to involve contemporary ideas and issues and interests of the community into the work. I'm always listening to what's going on in our community and then transferring that through the art and giving that back to the community.
The choice of the tarot is an interesting one, and it has, you know, there are any number of directions you can go. It has ancient roots, obviously.
It does, but being a contemporary dance theater, I like transforming the ancient into the current and putting the Iona twist on things. So it was a super fun project for me, and I always had an interest in the tarot, and still do. I still have my couple of decks at home. And
well, it wouldn't have lasted this long if there weren't a way to make it sort of continually new and relevant, yeah?
Yeah, that's true. And there's constantly new tarot decks coming in, out on the market, a lot that have to do with the feminine, you know, ideas,
mm-hmm.
very popular theme these days.
So it fits in with other shows you've done and
well, it does in that I love Jungian, Joseph Campbell's work in archetypes. And so mm-hmm. the majority of my shows deal with a lot of archetypal imagery. And Iona's work, as you know, is very visual. So that lends itself to the use of archetypes. So the tarot is just a bunch of archetypes, really.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of getting back, really, to the shared origins of myths. Legends from different parts of the world, right?
I love it. And I love how all of the different myths and legends coalesce,
yeah.
and we see the line that goes through all of the different cultures is really the same.
That was really Joseph Campbell's great mm-hmm. Sort of introduction to the world of thought, wasn't it? The common threads.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the goals in my work.
The
really
quest,
to show that.
The Fisher King, all the
mm-hmm.
the idea of seeking
Mm-hmm. He would love the Living Tarot.
I wouldn't doubt it.
And if I can find a house, I'd love to do the other 12 major arcana cards.
Sure. Well, maybe that's a possibility. What's the future for live performance of the kind you've done in the past?
Well, we are starting work on a new evening-length production, which we are aiming to premiere in two phases. One would be sort of a collection of preliminary works next season in 2014 called Iona Unplugged.
Mm-hmm.
And then the premiere of the full work at the Hawaii Theater in 2015. And it's about animals and group consciousness among mm-hmm. animals and how that relates to the group consciousness that I think is being developed through the World Wide Web.
So the web being sort of the contemporary herd, if you will.
You got it. Yeah.
That didn't give too much away, I assume.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's interesting. There's a little bit of animal rights issues addressed in the piece as well. As a lot of technology in there, too.
That sounds like an interesting show. Thanks.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I bet. Thanks very much for coming with us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much.
Great to have you. Cheryl Flaherty is the artistic director of Iona Contemporary Dance Theater. Its e-season is kicked off online this month with The Living Tarot, and you can learn more about it from our HPR website.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Carol O'Neill of Honolulu, Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Wilson of Hilo, and Christine Copes of Papa'iku for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:26. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. The hottest item on the University of Hawaii Board of Regents agenda Thursday will be discussed behind closed doors. Why is the public being shut out of talks about a new UH president? CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair has a couple of ideas and joins us for today's reality check. Hey, Chad.
Oh, boy, do I have a couple of ideas.
Yeah, I know you do. Because, I mean, really, this boils down to what specifically they're going to be discussing and whether or not that means they can invoke that part of the Sunshine Law that allows them to not be able to or not be available to the public.
That's right. You know, as a public board, the Board of Regents has to follow the open meetings law, the Sunshine Law. But there is a clause in there that grants an exception. And I'm just going to read to you from the law itself. They can go behind closed doors to discuss, quote, the higher evaluation, dismissal, or discipline of an officer or employee, or of charges brought against an officer or employee, blah, 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 basically having to do with personnel matters and privacy matters. And that is something that the Board of Regents, or at least their spokesperson, is saying they will be doing. The irony here is the resignation of Marcy Greenwood 2 years before her contract, the big wonder blunder discussions, the huge outcry from the Senate, House Senate, the Hawaii Senate, for transparency and accountability. And here the Board of Regents are going to go behind closed doors to talk about something that is so important to everybody in the state of Hawaii.
But the one part of that is that depending upon how specific they're going to get about very pointed issues with very targeted people is the part of the privacy aspect of it that maybe people shouldn't know.
That's right. And UH spokeswoman Lynn Waters said that the board will actually be discussing specific individuals as a possible replacement for Greenwood. But Bev Kiever, and I know you know her well, UH professor, retired, big open government advocate. Let me read a quote to you from her. Quote, "It's a slap in the face when the public and the legislature is demanding more transparency to build public trust. They," meaning the regents, "should bend over backwards to be more open, especially about how they're going to be looking for a new president. Instead, they're hiding behind this clause, this exemption that is in state law."
Well, we've all been demanding, you know, more transparency. And the question is, though, when is the transparency appropriate? When is it not appropriate? Part of it is, you know, in her quote, and that sounds just like Bev, you know, looking at...
Doesn't it?
looking at the issue that, you know, we've all been feeling, which is we're shut out, that somehow there's this giant gulf between what's being discussed and where we all fit into it, and yet this is a public institution. And then the other part of that is, as we've been talking about, privacy issues and some very targeted and perhaps not very nice things about people they're going to discuss on Thursday.
It's a sensitive issue. Remember as well, Greenwood paid nearly $500,000. That's taxpayer money. She also had a housing allowance.
$60,000.
That's another issue. Yeah. So that's another issue of great public interest, Civil Beat would argue.
Okay. Well, to be a fly on that wall. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Buzz. Thanks.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honua Kai Resort and Spa, with studios, 1, 2, and 3-bedroom suites on Maui, dedicated to creating a place for kama'aina who enjoy traveling together. HonuaKaiMaui.com.
It's time I'm walking to New Orleans.
The city of New Orleans had a profound impact on John Kennedy Toole when he wrote his classic novel, A Confederacy of Dunces.
Each neighborhood had its own character, its own sound, its own dialect, and he could just wander through his city and encounter all of these colorful characters.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursday nights at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa, and I've got Bert on the line, and we're talking about design thinking. Yeah, Bert?
Yep, we invited a couple of, let's say, institutions to talk about how they're incorporating this idea of innovation in their organization. So we have Waipahu High School, educational institution, and we also have Hawaiian Telcom, which is a major corporation here on Bishop Street, and wanted to find out how they're using principles based on design thinking to kind of create this culture of innovation within their organization.
How is design thinking different from the other kind?
Well, you know, I guess there's all kinds of ways of incorporating this concept of innovation, and I think everybody has their own methodology. But design thinking basically takes you through kind of a systematic five-step process. And if you can kind of stick to, you know, going through this process, it's a way to, you know, instill that mentality within the organization. So it kind of starts off with this empathy, define, you know, do ideation, do a prototype, and do some feedback and testing. So We'll kind of ask them, you know, exactly how they see implementing this and how do they see sustaining it over time.
Well, it's also interesting that they've got a partnership between a big company and a local high school, yeah?
Well, you know, design thinking is just a methodology, and it came out of Stanford University. And it's being presented here, and I think what's happening is that education is one of the primary areas where, you know, design thinking is being offered. But then there's corporations that also see the need to maybe instill some innovation within their organization. So it's kind of a combination of, you know, starting off with education, but seeing that there's interest in corporations as well.
Sounds good, Bert. That's tonight at 5 o'clock on Bite Marks Cafe.
Thanks, Chris.
It was a good year to stop human trafficking. Three bills initiated by the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery passed. Another one, which focused on child victims and was part of the governor's package, died. But in the never-really-over-world of the legislature, that bill was revived. Catherine Jean is the executive director of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, and she joins us this morning. You know, when we talked, Catherine, right before the session opened, you had very high hopes. But it seems that they've been exceeded by what actually happened this past session.
Yes, we're very pleased. This was by far our most successful legislative session in the past 8 years of our policy change work there. And we feel that we've taken a big step towards addressing the ending of the demand for sex trafficking and prostitution and protecting our children.
Two of the bills specifically work with the end demand part of your agenda. Then there's the hotline posting, and at the very end, being able to revive that part for kids to have at least a partial safe harbor.
Yeah, it's the first step towards addressing the way our state treats juveniles at risk. And it was a really great incentive by the governor and the administration to revise the definition of harm in the child abuse statutes to include child victims of sex and labor trafficking, because the child abuse statutes historically only addressed familial or household member abuse, and it wasn't expensive enough. So we helped revive that piece of legislation from utter death, and so it was like the phoenix rising from the flames, because without that definition, it would have been exponentially harder for us to attack a more substantial systemic policy change next session.
Now you've got to raise some money to actually create a place where all this can happen.
Right, and that is a really critical need. There are so many children at risk in Hawaii, and since we don't have a sex trafficking statute, it's really hard to get the stats, but we see them as direct service provider for these children. And what happens is that we often have to look for facilities on the mainland to be able to take these children in and provide them the adequate residential treatment that includes mental health, and education. And we can provide that here in Hawaii, but for some reason, you know, that effort is slow in coming. But it's an absolute urgent necessity. If you look at some of the recent statistics and studies that have come out in the public light about what our juvenile justice system has been doing to children, nonviolent children of color that are status offenders, and by status offenses, I mean nonviolent crimes like runaways.
They ran away, and they were running away from something that wasn't so terrific.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, these aren't just kids who got angry and said, I'm going to run away from home. They were really running away from danger.
Right. So the juvenile justice system has historically blamed the victim, the child.
And criminalized the kid.
Right, for being a juvenile delinquent, quote unquote, because why should a child run away from home? Well, they must be doing something wrong, not the other way around. Kids run away for very good reasons, either through neglect or abuse, sexual abuse, and those things are not often talked about.
No, and for the kid to look at going out and being on his or her own on the streets and facing those kinds of potential dangers, that pales in comparison to what they think they already know, which makes it a reason for them to simply leave home. And, you know, you can go down to one of the Apple stores and just hang around and see some of the kids who kind of come in there and know. And I was there with one of my children who said to me, you know, we know some of these kids are homeless. And yet that's their way of being able to connect to other kids and other families and maybe find some little place where they might be able to stay.
Right. Kids in Hawaii who are homeless or repeat runaways, they're at high risk for sex trafficking. Really high risk. And Hawaii has a very big problem with its homeless population amongst children. And typically we need to, I mean, we definitely, bottom line, need to revise the way and reform the way we treat this population, because incarceration and detainment is not an adequate resolution. What the incarceration system does is further not only criminalize these kids, but foster and promote antisocial and psychotic behavior. within that system, because the logic is if you put a child in incarceration and treat them really badly, they'll never want to come back
again. They'll hate it so much that they'll just say, I'm not going back there again. And that's a very infantile way of looking
right.
at it.
Right. It doesn't happen that way. What happens is that child comes out traumatized and therefore acts out based on very acute trauma sometimes of what she or he sustained in incarceration.
And perhaps more predisposed to being even more antisocial and having more issues that could have been taken care of if there were the right people there to help.
Right.
How many kids are we talking about in Hawaii?
Well,
it's very hard to be able to get a number on that, but
we estimate as far as the high-risk victims for sex trafficking, about 100 a month are at high risk for sex trafficking, and of that, probably a quarter will be engaged in prostitution. Now, the way the state and federal law define children engaged in prostitution is that we don't blame the victim. We don't blame them. They're not child prostitutes, quote-unquote. They are victims of sex trafficking, because what we can attest to, the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, absolutely 100%, there is no such thing as a child, quote-unquote, child prostitute in the streets of Waikiki. There's absolutely none. It is too territorial. It is too high profit for traffickers, and it's so easy for traffickers to manipulate and force, entice, not that that's a necessary element to prove sex trafficking, but to control these kids and make money for them.
So having said all of this, and now looking toward next session, you're already drafting legislation and looking at how you build on all of these 8 years that it's taken you to get to this point. What happens next year?
Next year, we're going to focus on the advertisements of brothels. the code word for these brothels are massage parlors, 24-hour massage parlors, not all massage parlors, of course, but 24-hour ones, and relaxation spas. They're openly advertising sex, you know, and they're doing so in very egregious, pornographic ways. We're going to attack that, and we're also going to focus on providing services for especially child victims of sex trafficking. You know, that also covers adults, but, you know, specifically sex trafficked children, we've gotten a bad grade for addressing by Shared Hope. They gave us an F for addressing that through law.
Whereas we've gotten a pretty good grade for everything else, or as a whole.
Right. As a whole, Polaris Project, which is a national anti-trafficking advocacy group, policy group, ranked us pretty high, tier one. It's the best tier, the best ranking for a state with regard to overall laws focusing on the abolition of human trafficking. But when it comes to children, that's an F.
Exactly what they told us when we talked to them, saying, you know, why aren't you looking at the issues surrounding children specifically? Well, obviously you are. Catherine Jean, thank you so much for coming in with the update, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Bethann.
Catherine Jean is the executive director of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery. Since 1999, she's been raising awareness of the trafficking of women and children for sex. In 2011, she successfully advocated for the introduction and passage of Hawaii's first labor trafficking state law. And this last session was her coalition's most successful to date, and already she's at work on bills for next year.
Hi, good morning. I'm Terry Madden from Playbuilders of Hawaii Theater Company. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier in the show, we remembered a Waikiki attraction from the 1960s, billed as a living village. Located at the Diamond Head end of Ala Moana Park, it was a place where people could step back in time and experience pre-contact Hawaii. Started by Herman and Malia Solomon, the genesis of the project came from a drive through the park and the discovery of an enclosure of neglected thatched houses. They learned those old-style hale were only used annually during Aloha Week, and somehow that just didn't seem right. They talked to the owners, negotiated a lease, and the grass shacks got a whole new life year-round. They became the backdrop for cultural activities showcasing various aspects of ancient Hawaiian life, including tapa making and poi pounding. And today we asked you for the name of this attraction and its two locations. Well, early visitors went to Ulumau Village at Ala Moana Park, but had to go to the windward side when it relocated to Kealohi Point in 1963. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
The horrors of the Third Reich are an abstraction to most of us. People who did not live through those decades when the world went mad can read nonfiction accounts of the World War and the Holocaust, but the sheer magnitude of the story can be overwhelming. Hawaii-born author Susanna Moore's new novel, The Life of Objects, looks at Nazi Germany's march to war through the eyes of a young woman who has left her sheltered past behind. Her eagerness to experience life brings the unfolding chaos around her into sharp relief. And Susanna's on the phone with us from Hawaii Island. Good morning, Susanna.
Good morning, Chris.
Good to talk to you.
And oh, thank you.
I'm reading the, you know, the setup, the opening chapters of the new novel, and it's a very, how would you describe her, a very sort of genteel young woman who loves Dickens. She loves to work in lace. And then you find out that she's going to Germany in 1938, and the time and the place tells you what you need to know about what she's headed for, don't they?
Yes, it was important to begin the book very slowly and more like a fairy tale. And I think it sounds like you got that, because so much is about to happen. There's so much horror is about to ensue that it has to start out with a genteel, quiet, almost pastoral, slightly romantic, and certainly innocent. You know, the character is, well, more than innocent, very naive, and in fact, quite ignorant. Because I teach writing, and one of the things I probably teach the very first day is that there has to be an arc, and so I had to. How do you write about the Second World War also when everybody knows about it? You know, how do you make it new and fresh, and how do you convey information that people already have? Really? How do you write about D-Day?
Well, and if you read, you know, the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich Berlin Diary, it's just it's more than you can stand. You know, that
it's more than you can stand, and also it's at the same time it's also familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very complicated.
But it doesn't sink in the way that it sinks in. And what I like about this novel is that you set up a very, as you say, an atmosphere of gentility. She loves Dickens. She's almost like a Jane Austen character in that she has a very, you know, I keep coming back to genteel approach to life. And, of course, nothing could be more antithetical to the Nazi ideal than gentility.
Exactly. Yes, and all that, of course, is deliberate to make the contrast and in some ways to. There's no need to heighten the horror of what actually happened, or of history, or of the violence. But you do have to, you know, as a writer, heighten the horror for her. So all of that was very important to set up in the beginning.
And you have to know her before you can understand its impact upon her.
Yes, or to care.
Yeah.
Or to care what happens to her.
And you do right away. I mean, there's a wonderful, there's a phrase I keep coming back to. You describe her adolescence as, a chaos of desire and disappointment, I think is the phrase. it's a great description of adolescence.
There's a lot of adolescence, I think, but Beatrice in particular, yes.
But that's, I think a lot of adolescents, our former adolescents, would identify with that line, don't you?
Yes, I think so, yes. I mean, and one hopes that we all outgrow it, you know, because you don't want to spend your life in that chaos. Although people do, of course. And certainly people do in time of war.
Well, most of us outgrow it anyway. But she's unusually vulnerable for the things that are in her future, isn't she?
Yes, yes. And that, again, was deliberate, you know, to use her as a kind of blank slate onto which I could project all this information. You know, when I began the book, I, too, was quite naive. I hadn't realized how difficult it would be. And as I, to repeat myself, one of the great difficulties was, what do you do with all this information?
Mm-hmm.
Not only how do you make it fresh, but how do you give it at all, you know, when it is familiar, and particularly familiar now because of film and television and popular culture, really.
And there's a danger of a kind of horror overload.
Yes, yes. And exploitation, you know, a kind of a cultural manipulation. You know, it's very tricky.
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, it's presented in so many different ways and imperfectly in the sense that it's very, very difficult to get the anything like the emotional impact of what was happening at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and one can't presume to even try that. That's why, you know, when I began the book, I always begin a book with a character.
Mm-hmm.
And even more than a plot or a story. I don't know too much, but I know the character. And I knew that I didn't have the nerve, the presumption, the knowledge, the emotional depth to write as a Jew or as a German during the war. And I knew that I had to approach it as an outsider. But then the object was to figure out who that outsider might be, because that was, you know, she couldn't be French because she'd have been arrested in 1940. All of the Americans were arrested and detained after Pearl Harbor mm-hmm. in 1941. Who could she be? So the fact that she's Irish isn't arbitrary. You know, so much of writing is really problem solving of that kind. Mm-hmm. You know, I have this, how do I get that?
Well, interesting that you start with character first. It sounds as if you create a character and then let events lead you along a little bit in the construction of the book. Is that accurate?
Well, I'm always interested in the way that that things are beneath the surface. You know, that things appear in a certain way, but what is really going on? And this, it probably comes from having a very difficult childhood. You know, where I was always trying to decipher not the truth so much, because I was pretty clear that was not going to be apparent, but, you know, to try to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get interested in the character or situation, and I then find myself thinking, what was really happening? What was she really feeling? What was she really doing and thinking? And then it just spins out from there.
Sure. Well, that's really Susanna. Thank you. That's a valuable insight into your method, and I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of this book, The Life of Objects.
Oh, thank you, Chris, so much.
Real pleasure talking to you.
And all right. Yes, you too.
Susanna Moore was born and raised in Hawaii. She's the author of The Life of Objects. She'll be speaking at this weekend's Book and Music Festival, and details are on our HPR website.
Support for today's programming comes from Four Seasons Resort Maui's Vintage Wine Weekend. The Oceanfront Gala is Sunday, May 26th, and features 40 wines, a locally sourced menu, and music by Makana. maui.fourseasons.com.
Hi, it's Lynn Rosetto Casper. We have another round of Key 3, our series on the recipes every good cook should know. This week, it's Chapel Hill chef Andrea Rusing. And we learn how to make the mysterious and suddenly ubiquitous kombucha. Join us. That's this week on The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Saturday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the Filipino Film Festival opening May 18th with Harana, a film about traditional serenaders. Learn more at honolulumuseum.org.
Just a little while ago in this half hour, we talked with Catherine Jean, the executive director of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, about the stellar year they had. But that stellar year was not an overnight sensation. It took 8 years to get there, which may be instructive for other organizations who are taking on weighty issues when at first people looked at them and rolled their eyes and really didn't want to touch it, because it's really kind of upsetting to talk about these issues. But perseverance, you can keep knocking at the wall until it falls down.
Well, it should be instructive because no issue gets resolved in the course of a, you know, one-year cycle legislative session, and the ones who succeed do it by dogged pursuit year after year and by understanding the process. I mean, we've seen some new initiatives in the last couple of years where the advocates got immediately angry at the first rebuff, and not necessarily anger that is productive of getting a good result. You know, you need to understand the process, get a bill written very effectively, one that can pass. A lot of pragmatism goes into the mix.
Especially when you're trying to talk about changing policy over the long haul, it's not going to change in a couple of years. And we know that, you know, you're lucky if you get a bill passed in the first 5 years that you've been trying to introduce it and make it happen. So
yeah, it can seem glacial sometimes.
And it did for them. But, you know, you can have successes too. And this year was a very good success for them. That's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, we're going to talk to Senator Willis Sparrow about his list of action items for prison and criminal justice reform.
We'll take a trip to one of the world's most remote places and hear the depth and complexity of Indian music.
You can talk back to your radio on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or get me at Because HPR.
You can check the archive on the HPR website. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.